Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Chad, I am holding a copy of a little book that I mowed through yesterday because it's not difficult to read. It is a new book published by 1517 called Paul and the Resurrection, Testing the Apostolic Testimony. So this is sort of a little bit of an apologetic work, but it's nice because it's small and you kind of get the theology that Paul has of the resurrection, coupled with the historical data and the comparative evaluation, all this kind of stuff. It's really good if you're interested in apologetics, but you think I don't want to read that big huge tome. This would be a great book for you. This is by Joshua Pagan. Looks like pagan, but he's not, because he believes in the resurrection. So he's not a pagan. He's pagan. That's how this works, right?
That's it. Yeah, I knew Josh years ago when I was teaching at the seminary. He was a student at the time. Super smart guy. He's done a great job with that book. You say it's short. It's only like 100-something pages. I mean, yeah. It's an easy quick read for not easy, but I mean, it's a quick read. He deals well with the subject, it's a good resource if you're looking for, you know, kind of an argument for the resurrection that's not just biblically based but also apologetically based.
Well, here, can we be honest about that? I don't know. Maybe I'll just be honest. I'll speak for myself, then you can amen me if it's true, Chad. There's times where even as a Christian, where you have this thing, you're like, am I insane for believing that some guy rose from the dead? You know, I mean, like, you do believe it, but every once in a while, some rational thing in your head, like, kind of comes in, married up with some doubt. You start listening to the words that come out of your own mouth, and you're like, I sound like a lunatic. What I found it did for me was when I put it down, I was like, I'm not crazy. It once again, in my case, at least once again, affirms that, oh, wait, no, actually believing in the resurrection based on what we know is reasonable. It's a reasonable belief.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. People will sometimes discuss the question, is there anything that would make you not believe in Christianity?
Yeah.
Well, and the truth is, yes. I mean, if the resurrection could be proved to be false, then our faith is null and void, and we are to be pitied more than all men, as Paul says there. So, yeah, I mean, the resurrection is significant, and having a rational, objective way to think about that, to think through the arguments for that is important, because, yeah. I mean, we have brains that God gave to us to think through these things and to look at the evidence. So a book like that's helpful in that regard.
Yeah. So you can look it up on 1517, or you can go to Amazon, wherever you buy your books, Paul and the Resurrection, Testing the Apostolic Testimony. I'll also put a link to the book in the show notes if you want to pick up a copy. Great little book. I'd encourage anyone who is interested in that sort of thing to pick it up. All right, enough about that. Where did we leave off last week in Judges?
Well, we were not talking about the resurrection, that's for sure.
No,
we got a whole lot of dead people instead.
This is true.
Yeah, we're right in the middle of a pretty gruesome narrative about our not so friendly Abimelech. So just to kind of catch everybody up as to where we left off here. So Abimelech is he's not the illegitimate son of Gideon. He's the son of Gideon and his concubine. That was not considered illegitimate back then. And the bad qualities that we saw in Gideon are like amplified tenfold when you get to Abimelech. It's like Abimelech looked at his dad and he's like, how can I be worse in these certain respects than my father was? And he actually achieved that, as we have already seen. He had 70 half-brothers, and he killed all but one of those. And that one that escaped, the youngest, Jotham, he's the one who gave us that fable about the trees who are looking for someone to reign over them. They go to the olive tree and the fig tree and the vine, and they all say no, and so they finally get the bramble to reign over them. So that is Abimelech. Abimelech is the bramble king. And Jotham finishes out that little prophetic fable by saying, basically, here's what's going to happen, or here's what I want God to make happen. I want Shechem to to destroy Abimelech, and I want Abimelech himself to be destroyed as well. And as we'll see, that's precisely what is going to happen. And that's kind of where we left off last time. So what happened is God sends this evil spirit, the kind of a spirit of rivalry and jealousy between the Shechemites and their would-be ruler Abimelech. And the Shechemites begin to harass people on the road, to ambush them, and making life difficult for Abimelech. And then where we specifically left off, there was just a symposium. A symposium in the old sense is a drinking party. So in the old Greek symposia, you actually got together and you had a party. You drank. And that's what was happening.
Lutherans still have these symposiums.
Yes. Yeah, we do. Yeah, there is a quite... It's quite etymologically correct for there to be drinking at a symposium. That's what happens. And that's what was happening in the town of Shechem. It says they had gathered the grapes of the vineyard, and they had this festival, and they go into the temple of their god, and they eat, and they drink, and they curse Abimelech. Things just haven't changed a whole lot.
Yeah. You
know? When people eat and drink, they tend to like, really get angry and say a lot of things about their bosses or their political leaders or whoever they don't happen to like at the moment, right?
Yeah, that's when the truth comes out and the unemployment line gets full.
Yeah, in vino veritas, right? So that's what's happening here. So you got these guys, they're cursing Abimelech, and one of them, I would read this with like a drunken accent, but I don't know if I could pull it off. I mean, I was thinking this morning, I could read verse 28, you know, like I was three sheets to the wind, but I'm not even going to attempt it. But I'm sure that's what was happening here, because this guy named Gaal, which ironically means redeemer, he wasn't redemptive at all, but that's what his name means. So Gaal, his dad's name is Ebed. He stands up and he's like, who is Abimelech? And who is Shechem that we should serve him? Isn't he the son of Yerubbaal? And is Zebul not his lieutenant? Serve the men of Hamor, the father or the founder of Shechem. But why should we serve him? And then, you know, he's kind of emboldened himself with this drunken speech about why should we be serving Abimelech? And so he has an idea. He's like, here's what we should do. I should be in charge. Would that this people were under my authority, that I'd get rid of Abimelech. And then Abimelech's not there, but he like addresses him as if he were there. And he's like, increase your army and come out. So Gaal, drunk, boasting, full of all kinds of bravado, is saying, hey, you should put me in charge. I'm the guy who should be running the show, not Abimelech. So we're going to see how well that works out for him the next day. But that's kind of where we left off. So one of the guys who's there, this fellow named Zebul, he's kind of the co-regent, I guess you could say, of Abimelech. Anyway, he's in charge of this city of Shechem. Well, he hears this, and as you might expect, he's not very happy about it. It says his nose got hot. That's verse 30, which in a Hebrew idiom, that means he's mad. So when somebody's, what do we say in English? Somebody got heated, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, something like that. In Hebrew, they'd say their nose got hot. They're mad. So his anger burned is the way my translation has it. And so he decides he can deal with this. So he sends these secret messengers to Abimelech, telling him everything that just went down. So look, this loudmouth named Gaal, he and his relatives have come here and they're stirring up trouble against you in the city. And he's not only going to report, he's got a plan he's going to give to Abimelech. So he says, here's what I think you should do. So come by night. So sneak in under cover of darkness. You and your guys, and you just hide out there in the field while it's dark. So, you know, get yourself all situated under cover of darkness and just wait. And then he says, verse 33, when the sun comes up, here's what you need to do. You rise early and you rush the city. And then when he, talking about Gaal, when he and the people who are with him come out against you, well, then you can do to them whatever you want. So you could have your military bloodthirsty fun with them. So that, anyway, that's the message that he sends with his messengers to Abimelech. Well, verse 34, I guess that was a good plan. It says Abimelech, all the people who were with him, they got up and snuck in by night, and they split into four different companies, and they laid in wait around the city of Shechem. Now, it's kind of strange what happens next. Verse 35, there's just like this dialogue between Gaal and Zebul, between the loudmouth and the co-regent there at the city of Shechem. It says they got up in the morning, and Gaal, he goes out there, and he's like stretching, standing there by the gate of the city, and Abimelech and the people who were with him see it, and they get up out of their ambush. And I don't know if like maybe Gaal had eyesight issues. Like he couldn't quite tell what was going on, because Gaal, he sees like the people coming, and he says to Zebul, he's like, look, people are coming from the top of the mountains. And Zebul says to him, oh no, man, you're seeing the shadow of the mountains like they're men. So Zebul, I guess, is like trying to convince him, no, you're seeing stuff. There's not really like military might that's coming down to take you out.
This was before glasses. So yeah, yeah, maybe this guy is just impaired a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I have great sympathy, because I've had glasses since I was 18.
Yeah,
imagine, if I took my glasses off, yeah, it would not be good.
Yeah,
I know you've got like perfect eyesight.
I do. I don't have the glasses, but I can imagine if you lost your glasses and then there we were, Chad, and you said, "Is that a bunch of guys over there?" And I said, "No, Chad, that's just shadows, man." And then you wouldn't argue. You'd just be like, "Oh gosh, man, my eyesight is terrible."
Yeah, yeah, that would pretty much be what would happen. You know, anytime I travel, I carry an extra pair of glasses with me, because I have this like phobia. Like if I get somewhere, I'm across the country, I'm speaking, so Pennsylvania, whatever, and my glasses break, man, I am in a world of hurt. So I feel like I'd be in bad. I could like walk. It's not like I'm walking into things, but you get any signs more than 5-10 yards away from me, and they are unreadable.
Yeah, so. you'd have to get out your phone to read from your thing, just blow the text up.
Yeah, that's how I'd be taking pictures constantly, trying to read them. So I carry my extra glass with me, just in case. So I have sympathy, a little bit of sympathy for Gaal, even though he was just kind of a drunken blowhard. But he sees, so he sees what he thinks are men, and they actually are, but Zebul convinced him otherwise. And then he says, oh, no, 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 no. Then I guess he hit close enough. He's like, people are coming from the highest part of the land, and one company is coming by way of the diviner's oak. So he sees like two of the companies heading toward him. Well, Zebul at this time decides it's time to like rub it in a little bit. So literally he says, ah, where's your mouth now? Which my translation is, where's your boasting now? But, you know, you were speaking all courageously and boastfully last night. So where are your words now? Because you were saying, who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Is this not the people whom you despised? So go out and fight with them. So that's what happened. Says that Gaal actually did. He went out before the leaders of Shechem, and he fought with Abimelech. But things did not go well with Gaal. We don't know for sure. I think he just like disappears from the story after this. The only thing we know, it says Abimelech chased him. It's not a good way to go out. Chased him, and he fled before him, and it says many fell wounded at the entrance of the gate. I mean, this kind of went down the way you expect, right? I mean, we don't know anything about Gaal. He was drunk. He was just full of himself. He was just, you know, like drunk people ordinarily do, just saying a bunch of stuff. And when it came time for the fight, he ended up getting trounced. So maybe he died, maybe he got wounded. Who knows what happened, but I'm pretty sure that is the very last we're going to hear of our friend Gaal. But it's not the last we hear of Abimelech. You know, this is a turning point in the story. You kind of think about where we've been up to this point with Abimelech. So he went to the city of Shechem, and he convinced them that it would be better for him, just as an individual, to rule over them than his 70 half-brothers. And they're like, that's cool with us. We'll even pay you from the temple treasury for you to pay the good for nothings that are in your crew to go and kill your brothers. So they pay him these 70 shekels. So there's, from the very beginning, it's like he wants to have this reign over the city of Shechem, and they want him to reign over them. So they have kind of this pact together. But as we've seen, this begins to crumble, and it's really going to crumble from verse 42 on, because Abimelech wasn't satisfied simply with taking out Gaal. He decides he's going to take out the entire city. So beginning with verse 42 down to verse 49, we have a complete annihilation of the city of Shechem. Because he goes out in 42 and there's some people in the field. He divides his soldiers up into three companies. They lay in wait. They ambush these people and they slay them left and right. And then they run to the city gate. Of course, the city gate was the main weakness of any place. I mean, if you took the gate, you took the city. So they run to the city gate, and it says that they were killing people left and right, fought against the city all day. Finally, verse 45, captures the city, kills the people who are in the city, and still that's not enough. He razes it. That's R-A-Z. He tears it down, flattens it, and as if that's not enough, he sows it with salt. I mean, Abimelech's he's an overachiever. He's going to make sure, I'm not going to kill everybody, and I'm not just going to tear it down. I'm going to make sure this place is so dead that nothing's going to grow in the soil. I'm going to sow salt in the soil.
Yeah, sowing salt is an interesting thing, isn't it? In other words, scattered salt as if it were seed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that way it's dead, right? This was not unknown in the ancient world. This is talked about in Deuteronomy. I think it's part of the threats of what could happen to Israel, some of the curses if they abandon the covenant. But this was not unusual in the ancient world it was like this wasn't done at every time. Well, like if you really wanted to wipe out for good a city, you burned it and then you took salt and you spread it everywhere because, of course, nothing's going to grow. So it was like I don't know what you'd call it. It's more than adding insult to injury. I mean, it's just like stamping out any future life in this particular place.
Salt in the wound, man.
Salt in the wound. Yeah.
Whenever you read the details of something like this, like I can't help but think, okay, so you go in, like what a massive undertaking. You have to wipe out the city, and then what, you're bringing in wagons of salt? Like how much salt is a city, man? Like how much salt? I just seeded my front yard. And so I wanted to make sure I had enough. So I bought seed. I didn't buy nearly enough. I had to go get more. It took so much seed for me to do my front yard, to seed my front yard, just bags and bags of seed. This is not a big yard. I mean, I live in a regular neighborhood. This is not a big yard. How much salt do you need to sow salt on this city? I mean, a lot of salt, I'm assuming.
A lot of salt. Yeah. Yeah. And it just shows the intensity too of, I don't know if it's hatred or if it's just meanness or what it is on the part of Abimelech.
Well, it's clinging to power, man. Like you're just willing to do whatever it takes to keep it. I mean, you think you have it and you're willing to go to just extreme lengths to make sure that, because this kind of thing seems like not just obviously you're really angry about this. And so this is sort of your wrath being poured out. But whenever this sort of stuff happens, you also have to think that this is also is supposed to serve as a deterrent from anybody else that gets a similar idea, right? So you go all out the first time so that if anyone else has any ideas when they're drunk about doing anything, that they'll think twice about it. They're like, well, that went crazy last time. I mean, we don't want that.
Yeah. This is like the Roman version of crucifixion, right? That was the reason they crucified people as a deterrent. So this is, it's probably in Abimelech's mind, he's probably thinking, I've got a long future ahead of me, and I'm going to be like conquering more cities. So I want to make sure that I send a message. You go against me, I'm going to tear you down. I'm going to sow salt in your fields.
Yeah.
And that's certainly a powerful message. You know, one thing that is a little bit unclear at this point, I mean, not unclear, but you get the impression that at this point, everything around the city is gone. But as we continue to read, we learn that there was actually one part of the city that still remained. So we'll finish out with that. And this is where part of Jotham's fable comes true. It says that the leaders of Shechem, they'd gone into the tower. So a lot of cities had these towers, and I guess this was connected with the temple of the god El Berit, the god of the covenant, which is elsewhere called Baal Berit. So Baal Berit, El Berit, whatever, same pantheon. They go into the tower because they're trying to get away, of course, from the fighting. They're trying to save themselves. So Abimelech finds out that they're at the Tower of Shechem. So Abimelech says to his men, "Follow me." And they go to this place that's unidentifiable. It's called Mount Zalmon. Zalmon is the word for like deep darkness. It's connected with, like, when we say the Valley of the Shadow of Death, it's connected with that particular word. So we don't know where it was. Anyway, some mountain around there, which had trees. And he takes his axe and cuts down a branch from the trees, puts it on his shoulder, and he says to his guys, "You do what I do and hurry up about it." So all his guys take their axes, they cut down these branches, and then they follow Abimelech and they stack these branches around the inner chamber of the temple / tower, and they set them on fire. And of course, you know the rest of the story. Everybody in the Tower of Shechem is dead, either from flames or from smoke inhalation. It says here that about 1,000 men and women died. Now, keep in mind that this particular death is a match for the prophetic fable that Jotham told, because he finished that up after he told his fable and he's haranguing the people of Shechem for choosing a bramble king to reign over them. He finishes that up by saying, "Let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem." So that's precisely what happened. These guys die in their tower, and they're killed by the very, well, there's also some irony here. So they're killed by the very one they chose to be their king, and they're also killed in the very temple from which they took the money to pay him to kill his half brothers so he could be their king. I mean, this is all kind of we could talk about this in a minute once we finish the story, but I mean, this is all just a great example of very often the bad stuff that happens to us because of the very situations that we willingly created, right?
Yeah.
This is it's kind of a Romans 1 kind of situation, right? God just kind of hands them over. This is what you wanted. Okay, you can have it. And now look what happens.
You would think that the children of Israel, later on, I know I keep going back to this, but it's my show. So you would think that when the time comes for them to ask for a king, that they'd be like, you know, there was a time where we sort of had like a set up leader guy. And man, that was not great.
Like, did not go well.
That was not great. So maybe we should think about this for a second. But it shows you, I mean, obviously this is generations later, but it shows you that you can be pretty ignorant of your history. And because I read this and I'm like, man, this would make you think, man, we're not doing this king thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd get all political on you and use some modern... modern examples of people's short-term memory, but people can draw their own conclusions there. But man, isn't that true though? I mean, it does not take, it doesn't take 200 years or 100 years or 400 years for people to forget, oh, that was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Let's try it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a man. If people define insanity by like doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. If that is the true definition of insanity, then humanity is insane, because that's exactly what we do.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, what's interesting about it is actually it mirrors what happens when Israel gets a king in a lot of ways, as far as you've got siblings rising up against siblings, trying to take people out so they can get ahead in the lineage, and that this kind of stuff happens all over the place then after this.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like the book of Judges just sets the pattern, and the book of Kings just continues it over and over and over again. I mean, we've got long-haired Absalom. He's taken out a brother or a half-brother. You've got all sorts of intrigue in the palace after that. Yeah, you got queens taking out sons around the time of Josiah. Anyway, one thing after another. There's a lot of bloodshed because, well, as we talked about last time, that's what happens with power, right?
Yep.
When you're thirsty for power, then you're thirsty for poison, and you see what happens with that. Okay, so let's take out Abimelech. It's time for Abimelech to die. So he's going to die at a place called Thebez. That's where he goes next. We don't know why. I'm assuming because he just destroyed Shechem. He's like, oh, you know what? I need some more people to rule over. I just killed all those people. So I'm going to go capture this city. So he does. But we have a repeat of the tower situation. There's a strong tower in this city too, and everybody runs into it, shut themselves in, and they go up on the roof of the tower. And here's where things get interesting. So Abimelech, he thought, well, that worked pretty well at Shechem, so I guess I'll do that again. It says he tried to burn it down too. But what he was not counting on was a certain woman with some pretty good biceps on her, because she was able to pick up an upper millstone, which was no small stone. I mean, these things are pretty heavy. So she picks this up and hurls it over the side, and it lands on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. Now, evidently, this was like, he didn't die immediately. So I mean, don't get the impression or the image in your head. He's just like, you know, gruesomely, his brains are all over the place. He's injured, seriously injured. He's going to die, but he didn't die immediately from this. So he doesn't want his memory to be that he was killed by a woman. So he's got this armor bearer close by, and he says to him, take out your sword and kill me, lest it be said of me, a woman slew me. And so the young guy did what he asked.
This is something I just can't understand at all. I mean, can you imagine like having such a fragile ego that you're like, I think I'm gonna die, cannot have it be said that a woman killed me. That is crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. Well, it's it's an insight into his personality, right? Abimelech is all about Abimelech. I mean, there's really nobody else that we can tell from anywhere in his story that he's concerned about besides himself and his oversized ego.
And by the way, this did not work. Instead of being known as the guy that got assassinated by his armor bearer or something, instead he's known as the guy whose ego was so fragile that he had to have his armor bearer kill him. So this actually backfires, because we're talking about him right now. Did not work.
Right. Yeah, Abimelech in his wildest nightmares could not have dreamed that two guys millennia later on a podcast would be pointing out that, yeah, well, you really did get killed by a woman, Abimelech. Sorry. So your fragile ego is just going to have to take the hit. And you know, this story was remembered in Israel, because this is probably something that some of you have come upon much later in the time of David, after David gets Bathsheba pregnant. Sorry, of course, he sends the note about Uriah to have Uriah stationed near the city wall, and Uriah is killed. Well, when the general is sending the messenger back with this particular description of what happens, he actually refers to this incident. It's his first in 2 Samuel chapter 11. So when the general sends a messenger back and he's describing what to what he wants him to tell David. He says, look, these things happen, right? Remember what happened to Abimelech? He was close to the city wall, and a woman threw a millstone down, and it crushed his head. Now, this is kind of an aside. I think that the general suspected what was happening back in Jerusalem and used that particular example of Abimelech being killed by a woman as kind of a jab at David, because this whole situation had been created because of his lust after a woman. Yeah, could be wrong. It's a conjecture on my part, but it's a little bit of an irony there in 2 Samuel 11. But anyway, my main point there was that this incident was remembered, and Abimelech will, for the rest of history, be remembered as a bloodthirsty, brother murdering, really fragile, egoed, megalomania who got killed by a woman throwing a millstone down.
You know, so far in Judges, we do see women doing the Lord's work when it comes to taking out some guys, because the text goes on to say, thus God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he had committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. So God sort of takes credit for this wiping out of Abimelech. So this woman was not just someone who didn't like Abimelech, and this is how the story went, but we're told in the text that this was the Lord's work. So we don't know about this woman, but apparently, much like driving a tent peg through someone's head, this is watch your head around these women, man. If you're out there doing nonsense, God will send a woman just to take you out.
Yeah. I wrote when was that? About 3 weeks ago. Anyway, I wrote an article for 1517, about 3 weeks ago, something like that. Can't remember the exact title, but something like Where's a Picture of Jesus Crushing Skulls? I don't know. If you're interested, you can check it out. But I refer to this particular story because I realized this a while back, that if you trace through the biblical story all the instances of people getting their heads crushed, or not just people, but even like Leviathan gets his head crushed in the Psalms, they're always the enemies of God's people. And sometimes, of course, women are the ones who are doing this. But it all begins in Genesis 3:15, right? The seed's going to crush the head of the serpent. And if we know anything about the enemies of God's people throughout the scriptures, these enemies are just basically the mask of the devil. So the devil is using these people like Abimelech, or like Pharaoh, or like the guy that Jael took out. God is using them. I mean, the devil is using them to fight against God's people. And they're all basically, when each of them dies, it's kind of a small picture of the bigger picture of what God is going to do through the Messiah when he crushes the head of the serpent.
Yeah. I mean, even the promise, given that, you know, the seed will crush the head of the serpent, there's obviously a woman involved.
Yes.
So it's not surprising that many times God uses a woman to do this, because God is in fact going, I mean, the promise is actually made to a woman, and certainly God is going to have a woman involved in this bringing about the seed to crush the head of the ultimate serpent, which is death and the devil, right? So yeah. So it's not really, we shouldn't be surprised that God's sort of commissioning women to carry this out sometimes, because ultimately he is going to commission a woman to bring forth the seed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have that in Genesis 3:15, right? Yeah. When he's talking specifically to Eve. I mean, when he says, you know, her seed, he's talking about Eve.
Yeah, he ain't talking to Adam.
No, he ain't talking to Adam. Yeah. So it's pretty cool. I love things like that, because these are small examples of how everything is woven together. I mean, and when you begin to see the big picture, you can see the little pictures and the place that they take up in that bigger picture. All right, we got about 4 minutes left. So what I want to do is we're gonna cover two more judges. Believe it or not, we're gonna cover the entire story of two more judges in the remaining 4 minutes.
Do it.
So hang on. Here we go. It won't take long, actually. So we got two more people. We've already encountered a couple of these people earlier on. You know, some of these judges sometimes are called minor judges. Minor only in the sense that a minor amount of the story is devoted to them. So one judge is Tola. He had kind of a strange name. Tola means worm. So I don't know what his mom was thinking, but Tola means worm. So
she was a little agitated. Maybe it was a bad pregnancy.
Yeah, maybe it was.
The childbirth didn't go well. She's like, yeah. Call him worm.
Yeah. Not a playground safe name, but that was what he was called. Maybe that's, you know, maybe he grew up tough. Who knows? But it says after Abimelech, Tola, who was the son of Pua, the son of Dodo. We have all sorts of strange names here. Tola, Pua, Dodo. And they're of the tribe of Issachar. So Tola arose to save Israel. That's probably why he saved. He's probably a tough dude. He's like the boy named Sue, right? He just grew up tough with a name like Worm. You're going to be tough when you grow up.
Yeah, one of it. Yeah, he's got Dodo in his lineage too. So that's not the greatest.
No. But anyway, we don't know anything about this guy except where he lived. Lived in Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim, and he was a tribe of Issachar, and he judged Israel for 23 years. And then he died, and he was buried.
That's all we know. This might be the best way to be. The more details you get, the worse it is. So yeah. With this guy, you can just assume that everything must have been okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I was going to be a judge, that's all I'd want to be said about me.
Yeah, you don't want
Chad, the son of Carson, lived in Texas, and he judged Israel. Then he died and was buried. Period.
That's it.
That's all we need to know. And then it's so much different. We have a little more detail with the next guy. His name is Jair or Yair in Hebrew is the way we'd say that. And he's from Gilead. And he judged just 1 year less than his predecessor, 22 years. But get this guy was never able to keep his refrigerator full because he had 30 sons. I mean, when my son's 19 now, but when he was he still eats a lot. When he was like 16, 17, he could like consume $200 of groceries in a single afternoon. It's like he never, ever got full. Well, imagine having 30 sons. Whew. Well, anyway, this guy has 30 sons, which, you know, of course, he would have had multiple wives. And they have 30 donkeys. Okay, it's good. One donkey for each son. And they had 30 cities. So each son... They divvied up the cities. You get a city and you get a donkey, and you get a city and you get a donkey, and all of these together, it's kind of a confederation of cities, I suppose. They were called Havot Yair, which just means the towns of Yair. And then he died, and he was buried. By the way, this is important. We'll finish here. This is important background. This isn't the only verse, but like when we get to Palm Sunday and you hear about Jesus riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey, that was how rulers rode very often. So this is one of those verses that will often get quoted for kind of the Eastern background of the use of donkeys. So the riding on a donkey was not the visualization of someone who wasn't a king, but actually that was what kings rode on. They didn't ride on war horses. So
because if you're just reading this, you might think this reads kind of strange because you're like 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys. And had 30 cities, and you're like, wow, okay, one of these things is not like the other. This is
right.
We went from like they all had donkeys and they all had cities, and you're like, okay. And this is why to your point, it doesn't say that they had 30 donkeys. It says that they rode on 30 donkeys, and so like sort of baked into that sentence is that they were regarded as rulers of these cities. Then, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. So he kind of spread out his rule among his sons. And that's, that's 40 minutes, and that's all we know about those two guys. We're going to pick up next week with Israel's sins. Imagine that. That's a strange topic. Never talked about that before.
Yeah, I've got a great header for next week right here. And my translation here, it just says, the further disobedience and oppression. That seems accurate.
Seems pretty accurate. All right. I guess we'll find out what it says.
All right. Guys, if you have enjoyed the podcast and it's been helpful to you, you can go over to 1517.org, go to the donate page. You can become a contributor. Makes it all possible. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Also, if you're interested in the book, Paul and the Resurrection, Testing the Apostolic Testimony, bolster up your faith in the resurrection. You can get that. I'll put a link in the show notes, just released from 1517. All right, Chad, I will see you next week.
All right, we'll be here.